call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Thursday, June 12, 2003. And the first thing we're going to do is do a public hearing on Senate Bill 287A relating to school food programs. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 287. Ms. Sexton, can you give us a recap from Legislative Fiscal's point of view?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Subcommittee members. Senate Bill 287 is before you in an engrossed condition. It came through Senate and House Committees on Education. And I'm going to be extremely brief because Senator Deckert, who is the chief sponsor of the bill, is here to explain it in more detail. So I'm just going to say that the materials in front of you are the staff measure summaries from those House and Senate committee activities so you can see what the committees discussed. And the fiscal impact statement that is representative of the $49,000 general fund appropriation that would be made to the Department of Education for payments to districts to conduct the summer school food programs, that would be converted into a budget report. And I'll just say here that that correspondingly the appropriation to the Department of Education for this specific purpose would be in the form of a new program for grant and aid for this purpose, and that the Department of Education's budget in the grant and aid area would be correspondingly reduced by $49,000. So it's a net zero in the department's budget on that purpose.
Is there any questions or comments for Ms. Sexton? Let me then welcome Senator Deckert and Representative Farr. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here with us today. And what I'll do is just open the floor to you to talk to us about this bill.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you for allowing us just a few minutes to talk about a bill that a lot of us have worked really hard on. Ryan Deckert, State Senator for Beaverton and Southwest Portland. This bill, Senate Bill 287, has come to you from the Senate and through the House Education Committee, where I believe it received a unanimous vote. Mm-hmm. It is very simply a creative approach and one of three bills that we have before us this session dealing with our unfortunate status as one of the hungriest states in the nation. The reason that this is unique is it really is leveraging the federal dollars that are available to the state of Oregon that right now we forego. Most of the operational budget for the summer lunch program, and we've really identified in this bill, you'll see 85% for the first years. So these really are those hungriest schools where 85% of the students receive already free or reduced lunch. And so we direct the resources, the $49,000 from the state to do the operational side, but really using those federal dollars to come in and actually provide sandwiches and chips and drinks for students who right now, and that's why we're kind of in a hurry, we're trying to get it to them for this summer, who otherwise will just simply go hungry this summer. Madam Chair, if I could just put one story on it that I have learned, is that in getting involved in this bill, I have heard from so many folks either through email or personal story, and we might have one or two of them with us today, that actually benefited from some of these summer food programs when they were young. And it has been really, I'll tell you, it's made a huge impact on me to hear how important it was to have someone come and provide a lunch program for a hungry family. And one who was, I believe, Miss Oregon, and she was from the coast, testified that they had a program like this in Utah using the federal dollars. And as hard as it was, her and all her siblings would gather once a day, Monday through Friday, and that was the one meal that they could count on. They didn't know about breakfast, they didn't know about dinner, and they didn't know about the weekends, but the one thing that they could count on in the summer was the summer food lunch program. So I really thank the committee for allowing us to come before you and for considering this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. I'd like to talk about a little bit different of an element. During spring break,
for the record,
Pat Farr from Eugene, representing state representative representing Junction City, Santa Clara, and Eugene.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. during spring break, had an opportunity to visit Fairfield Elementary School, which is in the district that I live in. And they have a summer lunch program there that they've been using, but they also operate it during spring break. And the lunch programs are far more than just lunch programs. What happens is a number of volunteers, in some cases very many volunteers, will gather around it. And it'll become more than just lunch, but it'll become morning and afternoon activities surrounding the lunch period, giving the kids something to do and some place to be while they're a single parent or both parents are working and they otherwise have nothing to do. So not only does this leverage significant out-of-state funds, it also leverages significant volunteer help that gives kids more than just a lunch. And I really appreciate your hearing this bill, and I look forward to carrying it to the floor.
Thank you very much. Representative Backlund, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, I am Vic Backlund, representative from District 25. I just wanted to add just a few words because this bill came through the House Education Committee. We thought the bill was an excellent bill. We heard some very, very fine testimony that definitely made the bill to me and to our committee members an important bill. And the only thing that concerned us was the fiscal impact. And so we're hoping very much that we will be able to fund this program. I think the food program that was described by both my colleagues to my left is an excellent program, and so I would urge the committee to adopt this, to pass this bill. Thank
Questions.
You.
Senator Mesevic.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe at one point in the discussions and the debates on this bill, it was mandatory, and I had a concern of what that would mean to rural schools, particularly that have to bus in the summertime. Has that been resolved? I understand now it's not a mandatory program.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Messerly, taking some of your concerns into account and others, I think when it passed through the Senate, the two issues of making sure it was fully funded and allowing it a more permissive model to really get the funds there and ensure, I think, the first year out of the chute, and we're really hoping it's this summer, and that's why we're trying to expedite this to the governor's desk. The first summer, someone behind me will correct this number, but it's about 10 schools, and they'll give you a list. You'll probably receive the list of the 10 or 15 schools that would be included, and I think Senator Gordley, who I've worked with on the summer program that she does, it could oftentimes be community groups, and I think that's what we'll see, is that many times, like similar to what Representative Farr said, is that you'll find community groups that utilize the funding to just ensure that these children receive an opportunity at a summer lunch.
Thank you.
Ms. Sexton, could you confirm to us whether this is permissive?
Thank you for that question, Madam Chair. Pull a copy of the bill. Well, first of all, Section 1 does indicate that in the 0305 biennium, the Department of Education may reimburse the school districts and community groups, as Senator Decker indicated, that have the summer food school service programs, and that it also is categorical to the degree of students who are enrolled for the eligible or are eligible for free and reduced price meals. There is no direction that I see in the bill that says that all districts must institute a summer summer school lunch program. I do recall the bill as it was originally introduced, and it did have the mandatory requirements.
It appears to me that the bill essentially proposes that a work group be formed to study the issue and report back to the next legislature on what happens with the pilot districts.
That's correct, and also the language that the local commissions on children and families have on their agenda a discussion of the school food service programs. It's my understanding from the testimony while it went through the House and the Senate education committees is that those things will be integrated without any additional cost, and that that there's not an expectation either on the part of the legislature or an understanding on the part of those groups that anything more than continuing to have the discussions that they're currently having will continue to take place.
Thank you. Senator Mesnevi, did you have a follow-up?
No, I'm fine.
Senator Corrigan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given the great need for the program, as has been illustrated through the example that Senator Deckard gave, I'm questioning the reason for the amendment in the House that reduced this from a three-year program covering 2003-2006 to a two-year program covering just the 2003-05 biennium.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, my recollection is that it would give the next legislature a chance to take a look at how effective the program has been over the next 2 years and perhaps make changes in the program.
Senator Backlund, did you have anything to add to that? I mean, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was a bit confused there for a moment. I think that is the correct interpretation. I think Representative Farr is remembering it as I did, and we thought that a quicker review period, a time period, would be a good thing to do, and so we made that change.
Well, I would imagine also, Senator, that there would be issues around one legislature not being able to embed another legislature to funding, but that this would be a part of the budget discussions.
Well, again, I am hearing the rationale, and I'm just going to say that I don't accept the rationale, given that there is so much need out there. How much more studying do we need to do? Why aren't we just taking care of the need? So I'll just leave it there.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, having served for 10 years on a school district that every site in that district would qualify for this program, but also knowing the problem that in one part of the district, this program would be opened up immediately and hopefully would be this summer. But other parts of the district, you'd have to bus kids for an hour in each direction to get them to the site. And I think that leeway needs to be there. And it appears to me you've built that in. You're requiring the Commission of Children to deal with this, along with the Department of Education, which is the requirement that should be in place. And then it's permissive after that. And I'm sure that the department and the commission will be able to come up with the appropriate administrative rules to exempt those areas where it obviously doesn't make any sense to do it, but to put in those areas where it does. I think that's exactly what you've done in this bill, and I think it's an appropriate way to deal with it. I can see the White City area as an example immediately doing this, but that Shady Cove where kids bus for an hour in each direction would probably choose not to. And you've allowed that to be permissive in that direction. I appreciate that. I think you did a great job here. It's a good bill.
Further comments or questions for the legislators? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate the time out of your very busy schedules. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3044 and open a work, or on Senate Bill 287, open a work session on Senate Bill 287. Committee members, do you have any further issues or questions that you want to raise now that we're in work session on the bill? And if not, the chair would accept a motion to move Senate Bill 287A to full with a do-pass recommendation.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley has made the motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is carried. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 287. And I'll open a public hearing on House Carriers. Senator Gordley, would you be so kind as to carry this in full and on the Senate floor?
Mm-hmm.
And Representative Bates, would you carry this on the House floor? Thank you very much. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3044A. Ms. Sexton, can you outline the contents of this bill to the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I will be brief again, recognizing your time constraints this morning. House Bill 3044 is a bill that deals with collection of debt owed to school districts by students or former students, and it outlines a series of procedural requirements that would be implemented by school districts. The bill is not specific as to a grade level, so it's assumed to apply across the district's programs, K-12. It did go through the House Education Committee, at which point it came to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. The staff measure summary from those discussions are attached. A fiscal impact statement that has been prepared by the Legislative Fiscal Office explains the processes that are included and where the kind of the cost points would occur without being able to define specifically any dollar attribute to each of those. I think Representative Backman may be able to explain the detail of this for you, and I'd certainly answer any questions after that.
Thank you very much. Representative Backlund, thank you once again for being here to talk to us on the bill. And could you please give us the benefit of the discussions that have taken place in your committee? And this is a bill that was brought forward at your request, so I would imagine that you have a good working knowledge of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Morgan and members of the committee. For the record, I am representing Vic Backlund from District 25. This did pass through the House Education Committee some time ago, but I hope my recollection is good. I hope that I can answer your questions. The bill was brought forward by the principal of McNary High School, John Bolander. He brought a similar bill to me in the 2001 session, and it had a hearing in Judiciary, but it had some problems, I think, and so this time we've restructured, and we think it's a good bill in its present form. The background for the need for this is that many students and their parents are quite careless, I think, about the obligation or the responsibility of taking care of certain school-issued books, athletic uniforms, PE uniforms, handling fees, and that sort of things that are assigned to students. It can be a real problem, and as a former teacher, I can certainly testify that it was very embarrassing also for a teacher. A teacher would be given a sum of books for the year, maybe 150 books, and it could be a history book, and those books might cost $40 to $60 or more dollars, depending upon the subject. And you issue the books and collect them at the semester time, or supposedly when a student transfers out of the school. But because there was basically little enforcement or emphasis given to the collection of those books, we lost a great number of them. And so the principal was concerned, and certainly I was. And we calculated, or it has been calculated, that that at McNary High School in this district of Salem-Keizer, Mr. Bolander brought in figures that showed perhaps $30,000 worth of books and missing uniforms and that sort of thing in 1 year was lost and not returned or paid for, despite the efforts to some degree of the school district personnel. Now this town, this city, has 6 high schools. This state has 286 high schools, and there has been some suggestion that you might average some $13,000 per high school, and if that's true, we're talking about an impact here of well over $7 million. So I also think in this day of emphasis on accountability and responsibility, this is also a good approach. So you've seen some of the particulars of the bill. One of the major changes we made from the earlier rendition in 2001 was to send the collection, if it came to that, to private collection agencies rather than the Oregon Department of Revenue. We think that approach would be more functional and would be more effective. Certainly, we would follow due process, or we would provide due process. There would be a letter sent out with a number of details, And there are a number of exceptions to the bill, so that if the total fine is or fee is less than $50, the fine may not be collected. If the expense of collecting it is greater than the fine, there are a number of exceptions built into the bill to deal with those unusual circumstances. So that's kind of a quick background, and we hope that you find favor with this concept and with this bill.
Representative Backlund, when the committee, when your committee heard this bill, was there any discussion from the districts about the possible cost of doing this outweighing the revenue that would be generated by it?
Chair Morgan, yes, particularly this was very evident or brought to our attention by representatives of the Portland Public School District. There are many students up there who speak a language that that perhaps the normal personnel wouldn't be able to send a letter and wouldn't know how to use the right language, and so they would actually go out and accompany and go to the home. And so these kinds of efforts would cost more than what could be brought in or to cover the fine or the fee. And so this is one of the exceptions. If the effort to collect the money is would cost more than the money amount itself, then this exception would be allowed. It would not have to be collected.
So there is exception language in here that exempts the district from the requirement if the cost of the collection outweighs the benefit.
Chair Morgan, yes.
Madam Chair, if I might, the specific language of the measure around that particular exception, though, is specific to the cost of the notice. Because as I understand, as I was listening to the testimony of Portland Public Schools and the representative from that district is here if you'd like more detail, but it was my understanding that because of the language diversity in that district, the notice provision was somewhat problematic for them. The bill then specifies that if the cost of the notice exceeds the potential for the recovery, but there may be other costs associated with recovering a debt that are not associated with the notice per se. That is, if a notice is provided in English or a language that they already do translations for, there may be other kinds of recovery costs. So they may want to discuss that.
Representative Backlund, when the bill was discussed in your committee, was there any consideration given or any discussion around putting a provision in that would make the bill permissive for any situations where the cost would outweigh the benefit that the district received?
Chair Morgan, I believe that current law is permissive. And we decided, Mr. Bolander and I in conversations and using my own experience as a longtime teacher, we decided that really it wasn't working very well by being permissive. I think school districts, at least the Salem-Keizer school district in which I taught, felt that there might be some public relations difficulties if they pursued the collection of fines or fees very vigorously. I think, though, that this bill is brought forward 2 years later, and we have a different climate. We have a real problem in terms of school funding, and so the bill now is no longer permissive. It is a mandate, with the exceptions that are built in, as has been described to some degree.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Are further questions or comments from the committee? Representative March.
Representative Backlund, I noted that there were two votes on this bill, but two nay votes. Do you know what were the sort of the arguments against the bill?
Chair Morgan, Representative March, thank you for that question. I think I may have touched on it briefly, and that is that it might cause some difficulty in terms of public relations for the school that would be trying to collect these fees. I think there was one concern expressed that this is kind of a mandate. This is not permissive any longer, and that seemed to be a problem with that particular colleague. Earlier on, there were some concerns about the lack of exceptions, and I think our amendment took care of those. I hope I'm not stepping being absolutely accurate when I suggest now that the objections, while they were recorded, were not as strongly felt in the end with the amendments as when we started the discussion. And I think we had three meetings. We actually had three meetings on this bill in the latter part of March, the middle of April, and again on the 18th of April. So we worked the bill pretty carefully, and we worked at it pretty hard to try to come to a consensus.
Senator Gordley and I very shortly have to leave to another meeting, so I would like to give Senator Gordley the consideration of asking her question before we need to leave.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I would like to hear from Pat O'Sullivan from Portland Public Schools. I'd like to know the impact on the Portland District, but I also see in the audience representatives from OSBA and COSA. I don't know if they're signed up.
Testify. Senator Gordley, we do not have a sign-up sheet on this bill, but it was my intention to bring Ms. O'Sullivan forward and give COSA and OSBA and anyone else who wanted to testify on the bill an opportunity to come forward.
That would be great. I'd really like to understand what is being perceived as an unfunded mandate on the districts from those perspectives. Please.
Thank you. And what I'd like to first do is there are other members of the panel that have requested to have questions asked of Representative Backlund.
Mm. Certainly.
So if Representative Bates, you were next on my list.
Oh, yeah. Did you have to leave? Did you?
I do need to leave. I would like to hear from Pat O'Sullivan,
before,
if that's possible.
Let that happen first, though.
Thank you, Representative.
Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Portland Public School District. I did previously testify on this bill, and Representative Backlund was gracious enough to include the exceptions at not at my request, but those are issues that came up, and he had amendments made. I'm really more concerned about the overall unfunded mandate. First of all, this bill doesn't include just high schools. It's a district. So where it would affect 10 high schools in our district, it now affects 100 schools in our district. There's no centralized mechanism right now in school districts to keep track of this. It's done on a school-by-school basis, and in some areas of high poverty, it's normally not really, the money is not collected for obvious reasons. Some of those exceptions are in there. We would now have to develop a system whereby each school collects all that information, probably brings it, and I'm just sort of guessing at this, but this is probably the way it would pan out, brings it into their school office, and the school secretary would have to figure out which of these exceptions applied to which kids who may owe money, and then after sending out a notice, which costs money to send out notices, you would then get some back and some you wouldn't, and some people would protest and some wouldn't, and then eventually you would send all those names into the central office where you'd have to deal with the collection agency in a centralized fashion. You couldn't have 100 schools dealing with a collection agency, so you'd have to now have somebody in the central office, and you could assume that somebody might be able to absorb that, but I don't know, for I don't think for our district they could, and I can't speak for your districts. So you would now have to set up a whole new bureaucracy within the school districts to do this. It might sound simple, and I don't disagree with Representative Backlund that there may be some money sitting out there on the table. I'm just not sure in today's economic world how we would set up a new bureaucracy without having some funds to help us do that. some new funds, because these would have to be new funds, a new system. You'd probably have to have some sort of database to keep track of it. Somebody'd have to have a relationship with the collection agency. So you can see it's not as easy. If it's a 2-school district, maybe, but not a 100-school district, not a 60-something school district like Salem, Gresham, Beaverton. So I'm really concerned about the unfunded part of this, and we did testify to that in the House. So this isn't new to Representative Backlund.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you very much for putting that information on the record, and I do apologize for needing to leave for a meeting in the governor's office. But again, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. Do we have any other questions for Ms. O'Sullivan? Senator Meserle?
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Not necessarily for Ms. O'Sullivan, but I do have questions. I've read from the background.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. O'Sullivan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm going back to my experience in 10 years on a school board of about 6,000 students, and what we'll call leakage of books and materials was significant, more so at the high school level, obviously, because those books didn't go home with the younger kids very often. But junior high and high school kids, we lost a lot of books and cost us a significant amount of money. But I never had an opportunity to do cost analysis. Would setting up this bureaucracy save more from the point of view of not buying more books, or would it cost more to set this up to get a return? I don't know if anyone knows the answer to that. Do you have any idea?
Chair Smith, Representative Bates, no, I don't. And it's not just books. It's athletic uniforms. It is a kid who may owe, I mean, I come from a kind of a different part of the state. Maybe some kid put graffiti on a building, and now they owe the school district money. Maybe they've, and that could have been in seventh grade. Now they've changed their life around, and we're saying you can't have your diploma because you haven't finished paying off your fines. That might sound okay, but maybe this kid worked hard to change your life. So there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts in here that are, when you mandate something, we did allow for some exceptions, which I'm really grateful for, because one of them was the safety of the child. And as you know, there are some homes where a child coming home saying, I lost a $35 book, could get them seriously injured. So, and districts, I mean, schools know that information. So there are those exceptions, but there's many more cases where this doesn't make sense. And I think that the local control of this, and maybe we're not doing as, I'll admit, we're probably not doing as good a job as we could. And a bill like this does serve a purpose, even if it doesn't pass, in that, well, I'm certainly going to go back to my district and say, what do we do, and can we do it better? But I don't know the answer to your question. Would it bring in more than this cost? I don't know.
Chair Smith.
Yes, Representative Backlund.
Thank you. Representative Bates. I think I would take a bit of exception to Mr. Sullivan's testimony. We currently, and I believe probably virtually every school currently, has the mechanism already set up, because we do turn in, we have turned in for years, lists of students with missing books. Typically that list is sent to the bookkeeper. They do that sort of thing all the time now anyway. Before kids graduate, they get a list of library fines, missing books. And some of the time, the students will pay that fines, but some of those fines, some of the times they will not. So I don't see that we have to have a central bureaucracy in the Salem-Keizer district. Each high school has its own mechanism and has had that mechanism for years and years. I don't see any addition to that, except, and by the way, we have sent out notification letters forever under the current system, which is permissive. We would continue to send the same number of letters out, except now we have a mandatory effort to go after those students who have responsibilities. So I have a little bit of a different view than Ms. O'Sullivan, and her perspective may be from the Portland public school perspective, but I suspect that all around the state already there is a mechanism in place to collect missing uniforms and books and fines and library books and that sort of thing.
Ms. Sexton, I wonder, Ms. O'Sullivan stated that if notices went home to students who had an abusive situation at home and it could get in serious trouble, does this bill allow for school districts to use discretion in that matter?
Madam Chair, yes, it does. That is one of the three exceptions that the school districts are directed by the bill to establish administrative rules and or policies, which they also then have to report and each year to the students so that the students and their families are aware of what the requirements are. But the three exceptions are that the district determines that the debt is not recoverable.
For whatever reason.
For whatever reason. Okay. And this may be because the student is one of the students eligible for a free or reduced price lunch. The second is if there is a potential risk to the student's health or safety, as Mrs. Sullivan referred to. And then the third one is if the cost of the notice, not the total cost of the debt collection, but the cost of the notice to the family or the student would exceed the cost of the debt owed. And that goes, as I refer in my fiscal impact statement, to the language diversity, in particular in Portland Public School District. The testimony that Ms. O'Sullivan had provided to the House Education Committee, they have some 80-some-odd languages or dialects that are spoken in that district. And so if a student was from a family with a really obscure native language, they would, in some cases, it's not even a written language, they would actually have to have somebody go out physically and do the interpretation at that point. So the language in the measure is specific to the cost of the notice to the student or the student's family or guardian, and not to the total collection of the debt owed.
Okay. I think that was a very thorough explanation. Do we have any more questions for Representative Backlund? Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of my questions have been answered already regarding the exceptions, but let me clarify this in my farmer mind. Is really the value of this bill giving the local districts the authority to withhold records and diplomas, or has that already been granted to districts?
Chair Smith and Senator Messerly, that's already granted in current law.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
But districts already have the authority then to request payments. So is the main value then just to put it higher on the radar screen and to try to recover more funds for the school district?
Chair Smith and Senator Messerly, I think the answer is yes. I believe the permissive approach has not really worked as well as we would like. And I also think that it's amazing to look at the rising cost of textbooks these days. It's almost incredible. I have some recollections of Mr. Bolander testifying to our House committee. He would sometimes, in the summertime in particular, go out to the homes of some of these students. He himself would do this, and this might be a family of three kids, four kids, and each one of those kids would have had a number of fines and lost books, and they did not return them, and he would find those books in the home. This earlier kid might have a $300 bill, a $300 fine amount. The second one is similar. The third one is similar. And those books have been in the parents' homes for a good long while, and nothing was ever done. I think it's reasonable to hold the parents accountable in this regard and students. I think putting them on notice will cause them to do a better job of returning the books. So responsibility, a sense of accountability is one factor or two factors, but really collecting books, and that's what we'd really like, is to get the books back or get the missing uniform turned in or pay, you know, that sort of thing. And I think we'd have some positive results from this.
Representative Bates, you have some questions?
Several, yes, thank you. Either one, you can field these, I guess. The exception process, just looking at it very quickly, doesn't seem, from my point of view, to change much what most boards are probably doing. I mean, it basically says, and I don't find a reference to free and reduced lunches in the bill as far as the ability to pay. It says the school district determines that the student or the parent or the guardian of the student is unable to pay the debt. And that's a determination by the district. So that gives you a lot of leeway, I would think, there. And I don't see it tied to anything specifically unless I'm missing it. What's interesting to me in the bill, and what potentially puts some teeth in the bill that may change things, is the requirement that the district use a private collection agency or the method available to the school district. Now, is that a change? I wasn't aware that was available to us before. I thought the Department of Revenue or something had to do it before. Has this changed anything?
Yes, Chair Smith and Representative Bates. The answer is yes. Our previous approach was to use the Department of Revenue as a kind of a backup if the parents or the student did not pay the fine. The Department of Revenue really wasn't very interested in doing that. This and the private collection agencies were because it has because there's kind of an immediate short time frame relative to many attempts to collect fees. Private collection agencies thought that they could bring back a good return. They could do well at getting these fines paid. And so this was our new approach in terms of comparing this bill in the 03 session to the one we had written in 01.
Representative Bates, and that's exactly what leads me to the part about the central bureaucracy that you now have to set up. If you do it school by school, like Representative Backlund had mentioned before, that's kind of currently going on. It's sort of a local thing. But now, if you're going to use a collection agency, you're going to have to bring it into the central office, at least in the bigger districts. All 100 schools are going to have to bring their information there, say, yes, we tried once or we tried twice, whatever your policy says, via a letter. And now we're required by this bill to turn over these cases that didn't respond or didn't have the money or whatever, I mean, didn't pay all the money, to a collection agency, and that takes staff time. That takes, especially with the amount that in the larger districts that you can imagine that we may have.
Okay.
Excuse me, Chair Smith.
Yes, Representative Backlund.
Representative Bates. A comment about the collection agencies. Excuse me. Collection agencies, once they receive the information from the school, would do the paperwork. They would work up the paperwork, and so it would pretty much free the school personnel up from doing that, and that's one of the advantages of using a private collection agency. Furthermore, the letters have always been sent out. So we've always had the postage, we've always had the staff time to send out letters under the current law, which is permissive. They go out to all the students, but there have not been the kinds of attempts made to really go after the collection of these fines. And so, again, I don't see that we're having or we're adding a bunch of new bureaucracy or difficulties or extra staff time. Mr. Bolander indicated that in our House Education Committee hearings, and so I feel fairly comfortable in when I understand that the private collection agencies will do much of that paperwork.
Well, it would seem to me, Representative Backlund, that there really isn't any teeth in the school district's ability to collect on these things. And I think once the patrons of the district realize that there are teeth, that the collection agency is going to go after them, it could change behavior for the future, whereas it may be cumbersome or could be bureaucratic to set this up in the first year. But I think as we go through the years, they're going to realize, oh, I either better pay the fine or return the goods. Because once this happens, you know, word will get out on the street, so to speak. Parents talk, kids talk, da-da-da, oh, my son didn't get his diploma. As a matter of fact, I think that happened to my brother when he graduated from high school. He went through the graduation ceremonies across the stage and got a blank piece of paper. He owed $50. And needs to say, my mother was furious at him. So there was some teeth in it, and he paid his fine, and it was just a little bit of laziness on his part. So I think this is designed to do is to change behavior and have an awareness of responsibility and so forth. Representative Bates,
yes.
Follow up.
The use of a collection agency is a significant change, and frankly, one I would favor. I think it does put teeth into this thing. The rest of the bill doesn't seem to be that much different than what's actually common practice in the state right now. And that's why zeroing in on this thing. Is there a reason that each site couldn't contract with a collection agency that had been selected by a district? I don't see the need to do this thing centrally. Most collection agencies work with small units of business. As an example, I oversee a business that has about 10 locations. It has a book of business of $10 million roughly a year. The agency we use work with each individual site to take care of collection problems, and it's very simple and straightforward. Admittedly, we only get picked for a cent in the dollar, but it does work. And my question is, why do you need to have a central bureaucracy to do this? Why can't each site do it, having had the district decide what the collection agency you're going to use is going to be? I mean, obviously, you don't want somebody else hammering people and get yourself a lawsuit. You want somebody who's reasonable and accountable. And I just don't see the need to go through the central bureaucracy thing, but maybe I'm missing the boat here.
Representative Bates, I think that would really be up to each individual district. On smaller districts, central office is the schools, so it's not a big deal. But in a larger district, when you have the possibility of some suits or mistakes, you always want to have your central office accounting people involved. I don't know whether it would be site to site. What we try to keep off of our principals' desks are anything that are more paperwork involved with things like this, and let them focus on the kids and, you know, student achievement and those types of things. So we try to keep off any additional duties that would take away from that, and I think Representative Backlund would agree to that. So it might be a district decision not to do it school by school for those two reasons.
Chair Smith and Representative Bates, yet Salem Kaiser is the state's second largest school district. And we've always done it school by school, as I've indicated earlier. And I think back on my own experience as a 37-year high school teacher and coach, I can't envision that we would set up any further bureaucracy. It's already in place as the current law is in place. And so I've had conversations with retiring principal John Bullander from McNary, and he doesn't see any change in the approach either, except now this law would allow some teeth to be there to get back these either the missing books or the product or fines to be collected.
Any other questions for the two sitting at the panel? Well, thank you, Representative Backlund and Ms. O'Sullivan.
Thank you.
I would like to hear representatives from COSA and OSBA, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I would draw your attention to the first page of the bill and the deleted language that's italics, and then the new language in bold. Anytime we see language deleted, which says school districts may, replaced by new language that says school districts shall, we get a little bit nervous. I am not aware, and I have not checked with our policy services folks, but I would guess that every school district has some policies and procedures in place which allow for the collection of debts owed by students. And certainly those policies are based on existing language which allows school districts to seek payment of those debts from students before issues and before diplomas and grade reports are issued. I think of particular concern in House Bill 44 is the fact that a school board may, by policy, waive that repayment of the payment of those debts, but only under certain circumstances. And when you think about 198 school districts and 550,000 school kids, I would submit that there are probably a variety of mitigating circumstances that a board may choose to waive going after a student for that debt if one of those circumstances happens to be in play. And so I would suggest that if you decide to advance House Bill 3044, we look at the possibility of an amendment to Section 4 that talks about school district policies that allow a school district to waive all or portion of the debt. So it's not only if the school district determines that the student is unable to pay or if the payment could impact the health or the safety, but other mitigating circumstances as determined by the school district board in their policies and administrative regulations. I think there's an advantage, perhaps, of the teeth in House Bill 3044 that have been suggested. School districts prepare for their students' student handbooks. And I think a clear statement in a student handbook that Oregon law says we're going to come after you if you don't pay this debt is important. And as Representative Backlund suggests, textbooks are much more expensive than they are now than perhaps when the statute was originally enacted. So there may be some value in creating some teeth in this collection process, but I also, in effect, creating the mandate that the language in this bill does, I would want to make sure that in the policies that boards adopt to implement this new law, that they have the flexibility to consider the variety of mitigating circumstances that may occur and, in effect, allow those schools and school districts to look at these issues on a case-by-case basis and make rational decisions based on what best meets local needs and circumstances.
Mr. Bennett.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, you've heard from the state's largest school district and the problems they face. We have not testified against this bill. In fact, I recall when it was introduced last session, I believe we testified in favor of it. We found the argument compelling, raised by Mr. Bolander, retired principal from McNary High School, who's talked with us about this issue, as well as the chairman of the substantive committee, that there is a problem out there, that there is an amount of uncollected debt that remains uncollected, and that from district to district, this can aggregate to as much as $7 million, which is a substantial amount of money out there that's not being collected. Most districts are much smaller than Portland. It tends to be a much more a much less difficult problem identifying, making contact, and then applying the sanctions included in this bill and collecting that debt. This certainly would clarify the situation for administrators as they try to deal with this issue and create a uniform expectation as to how this would be handled. Saying that, though, we're like Mr. Marshall and Ms. O'Sullivan, we've been concerned about unfunded mandates and mandates of any sort, and we hate to leave that can't behind, but I think in some cases it does become a can't, and I think in this case it's one that you certainly can take a look at this and see that there is at least a description of a problem out there that this may assist in resolving. We are still concerned about the problems that Portland may face. They have such a unique situation with the number of languages involved. Perhaps the size of the district just leaves it in a more difficult situation. So as you weigh it, we hope you look closely at the problems Ms. O'Sullivan described, but often Portland's problems can be unique and different than Ashland or SIO or other smaller districts. So leave that open.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a statement, I guess, not a question of our staff. I'm having trouble accepting your remarks about the larger school districts having a more difficult time dealing with this. I think it just doesn't make any sense to me that the economies of scale also have to come into play. And there's a process that they're all going to have to go through. But for the smaller school districts to set that up and spread that across less students, I would think would be more of a burden. But the question I have for our staff, I'm a little confused here as to what we're supposed to be dealing with here today. I'm hearing a lot of policy talk, and it seemed to me that what we ought to be looking at is the fiscal ramifications of this, and is it a fiscally a valid bill that we ought to be accepting. And I'm a little nervous that we're debating a lot of policy here, that really it's been through a policy discussion at the House committee, and we'll again, I assume, do that in the Senate. And are we off bounds?
Madam Chair and Senator Messerly, there can sometimes be a fine line between what is policy and what is fiscal or what is budgetary. And that's always a conundrum as to whether the dollars drive the budget or does the budget drive the policy. In this case, because we're not able to be specific as to what each component of the bill does fiscally to each district or even to a sampling of districts or even to a range of districts in terms of how does this affect big ones versus little ones versus the medium-sized ones, because it's all comparative with what each district is currently doing. Districts have policies, as is represented here. We don't know how aggressively some pursue. We don't know the level of debt owed in one district compared with another. And so the effect of the bill as you have it in front of you can't be quantified. I simply have no way, short of conducting a study, to find out what the comparative functions are at a district level or a school level, how successful they are with their particular set of demographics in recovery of debts, and what the implications of the bill's provisions are on each of those districts as a mandated requirement. I wish I could answer your question more directly, but I think in this case the policy discussion and perhaps the suggestion of Mr. Marshall regarding an amendment insofar as the waiver permission being expanded to allow for more district flexibility in terms of other mitigating circumstances, how that ultimately affects the costs to the district for pursuit, certainly if they at a local level determine other factors to be mitigating, that would reduce the requirements under the provisions of the bill. But again, cannot put any kind of a dollar feature on any of it.
Do we have any other comments?
I could follow up on
that. Yes.
If I understand the rules that we operate by, the amendment that's been suggested would have to have a letter of concurrence from the chair of the committee mm-hmm. before we could act on that. And it would seem to me that our role here is to get a sense of what the impact is on the total funding for the school from the state and what that impact might have on our obligation with the Common School Fund to bring it back to our level. I think the discussion's been good, and I understand how the operation works and some of the needs of it. But and I could be corrected, but that's kind of the way I'm putting it together.
Well, Senator Messerly, I think we may be possibly be reviewing an amendment and talking to Representative Backlund and getting his feelings on that. I think the purposes for the hearing today, of course, we don't have a quorum to vote on this, is that maybe we need to talk about this further. And I, for one, like the bill. I see a lot of positive in it. I think we need to give school districts some teeth. And I do think that in the end it could ultimately change behavior of not only the children but the parents and how our parents are raising some of their children to be responsible and respect books and property that is not your own. And I see that very much lacking in our students and society today coming up. So I think we do, however, need to allow maybe a little bit more latitude in the waiver as far as the fees and undetermined factors, and I think we're going to work on that. So with that in mind, we're going to close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3044. And now we're going to open an information session on House Bill 5009, the Community College and Workforce Development. Thank you. Cam Forrest-Brawley, would you like to come up?
The funding formula. Oh, goodness.
Oh, yes.
Fun never ends. Excuse me.
No, you have to stay. Do you want me to sit down closer to you so we can talk? Is that necessary?
It's up to you. It's fine if you want to. Sure.
Okay. I will move my stuff. Well, hi. How are you? Okay, Mr. Bender, would you like to brief us on the materials you just handed out?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. We've distributed to you two sets of materials. The first set is a presentation on the funding formula that was prepared by the department that you requested of them yesterday. So they are prepared to make that presentation to you this morning. And then there's a second set of materials stapled together that LFO has prepared to review some of the decisions you've made and just to bring up additional information. We expect this to be the last work session on this budget until you come back at some future time to make the decisions on general fund appropriations. But with that, I leave it to the department to begin their presentation of the formula, as you asked them to.
Madam Chair.
Senator Messerly.
It's for Mr. Bender. I assume that means that should we have additional budget notes, we can bring them in at a future work session?
That's correct. It will be
thank you.
There will be future work
sessions. I wanted to clarify that.
I think it was the intent of the chair that we go through this budget information, funding formula information, and two, after that, is to have a discussion, Senator Messerly, on the property tax business. So, Ms. Forrest-Brawley, would you like to continue?
Good morning, and for the record, Cam Forrest-Brawley, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do have a brief presentation this morning, and I have asked Brett West, who's the Assistant Commissioner, to join me this morning to walk through that presentation.
Mr. West, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brett West from the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. You have before you a 14-page handout on the community college funding formula. About half of the information is information you've seen already in prior presentations and is here to refresh your memory. Beginning on page 2, we talk about the components of the formula. We do include the state appropriation, one half of local property tax revenues imposed. There is a base factor to recognize some of those fixed costs. That also includes a small school adjustment to recognize economies of scale. We include funded FTE, which at this point is frozen at 2001-02 levels. And for next year only, there is a gap adjustment. And we have not included that in the rest of the presentation in the interest of simplicity of the presentation. On page 3 is a picture of those components. This was presented in day 3 or 4 of our Ways and Means hearings, just a simple schematic of what was on page 2. Pages 4 and 5 then show, based on the governor's balanced budget, that we begin with $401.9 million. We subtract $3.4 million in funding for items such as corrections, out-of-district service, distance learning, and the annexation of Hood River County to Columbia Gorge Community College District to get a net of $398.5 million. Divide that by 2 for each year of the biennium, and that leaves us $199.3 million. Add to that 50% of property taxes and get the total amount of money that goes into the formula, $251.7 million. From there, we have to subtract money for the base factor, and that's 11.7. And so we were able to run $239, almost $240 million through the formula on a per FTE basis. And with the funded FTE we have for each year of next biennium, that leaves us $2,498 to allocate on a per student basis. Pages 6 and 7 show two specific colleges and how the calculation for them works. You can see for Lane Community College on page 6, the base payment, $694,100. They get $2,498 for each of their 12,694 FTE to give them $31.7 million through the formula. Or add the base to that to get to the $32.4 million formula resource amount, and then subtract their 50% of their local property taxes to get to their $26.2 million state aid amount for 2004-05. The same calculation for Blue Mountain Community College is shown on page 7. I won't walk through that one. Same principles there. On page 8, then, just a few things to remember. That this is not a funding formula in the sense that we get funding from you for the community colleges, but rather once we get the money, we use this formula to distribute the funds. The information we're presenting today is based on the governor's budget and on our current estimates for next biennium's property tax imposed amounts. And again, as we've said before, we will develop a new formula for 2005-07. The formula is pretty simple, really. Hopefully that gives you an idea of the calculations. One point I will make is that between our presentations to you in April and the calculations shown on pages 6 and 7, we have received updated property tax information, so the numbers then would vary slightly from what you saw in April. Generally, those numbers come to us in late April or May from the Department of Revenue. Mm-hmm. Pages 9 through 14 are the charts from the presentation we made earlier in April. Page 9 shows each college's actual reimbursable FTE, and you'll notice that number's higher than what you saw for formula distributions, and that's because we did freeze FTE in place. So that difference is explained by that and the fact that it also includes some of those categorical line items that we don't distribute through the formula. You can see the rates per thousand for each college, the amount of property taxes that actually raises, and then a calculation of the taxes per FTE on a college-by-college basis.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Miserly.
I'd like to point out, and first of all, I'd like to say that I appreciate Cam and her assistant here have met with me last night, and I met with Cam the night before, and I've really been trying to understand how this all works. Mm-hmm. But one of the issues that's bothering me is that this is the formula, and how they calculate the formula is really based on the taxes per FTE, is my understanding. And as I look at those figures of all the community colleges that are losing because of the formula and all of those that are gaining, the wide spread of the tax dollars generated per FTE. For instance, in those that are losing, it varies from $971 per student to almost double that at Central Oregon at $1,800. And that seems to me that maybe the model is flawed if it's varying that much, because there's a lot of other factors that might be influencing that. On the same token, by those that are gaining from the formula, it ranges from $376 per FTE to, what's the highest, $992, is that right? With Klamath, I believe. But you can see it's also a wide variance, which indicates to me that there's other factors there that are influencing that, which the formula possibly doesn't consider. And I accept the fact that the task force that's working right now and will continue to work, I assume, is going to be looking at those factors.
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, you're correct. We will be looking at those. And you are also correct in that there are many factors that impact the taxes per FTE from property values to tax rates and the number of students served.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up on that.
What, Senator Nesserly, I was going to try to get through this first little presentation. If we could just let Mr. West run through it and brief us. And then after that, could we get into more specific questions then, if you don't mind, sir?
Sure, that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. West. Continue.
Thanks, Madam Chair. On page 10, this was presented earlier also, and shows the impact by college on state funds by having 50% of property taxes included in the formula. On pages 11 through 14, then, or 11 through 13, you see the impact of three different ways of running the formula. The top page 11 shows the resources per FTE that come from or that go to colleges. This is 100% of income taxes and 100% of property taxes after the formula is run. There's a range of you can see the range above and below the 3,135 number. On page 12, you can see that if we exclude all property taxes from the formula, the range grows pretty significantly. And on page 13, if we include all property taxes in the formula, the range per student is narrowed pretty significantly. And then finally, and those, all of these charts were handed out earlier. And finally, on page 14, I believe Representative Bates asked the question, if I remember correctly, and this was part of our response, not our presentation, but this is the same chart that you see on page page 10, extended out to include the impact on overall budgets by having property taxes in the formula for both the current biennium and the past biennium. I'm sorry, the current biennium and the future biennium.
Thank you, Mr. West. Cam, do you have any comments so far?
Madam Chair, no.
Okay. Question, Senator Mesrally.
Well, Madam Chair, I just would like to point out that if I understood the statement, that the present formula, yes, there are many factors, what I heard testified, but it's my understanding that the present formula does not include those other factors, or at least does not adequately.
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, the factors that we talked about last night regarding such things as the ability to pay and different income levels in the different districts, you're correct, those are not included. We do include the other pieces, the total revenues, but the issues you're talking about, I think, are not in there.
I'm sure if I could follow up, there's other issues in my mind that would show the wide variance, as was stated, local economics of each region, the local vision and the local offerings of each campus, I think, varies widely. And quite frankly, the local capital needs. I know some of the campuses are trying to get ahead far enough to remodel or build buildings and build a campus, and others are renting. And so there's a lot of factors such as that that I think make a difference. Also, it shows to me that there's efficiencies of scale. When you look at the cost per student, between Portland, as an example, with some of the other campuses, it becomes pretty evident to me that that's another huge factor in the cost of providing access. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Messerly. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not a simple issue. The formula may seem simple to you, but to others it's a little more than that. And I've looked at this for some time now, and everything when I can get my arms wrapped around it, I have something else that pops into my mind. But what I think what they're trying to do is obviously level the playing field, but unfortunately I think the formula doesn't work anymore. There's been changes as far as property taxes that are dramatic. I refer you back to, I think you gave me information that prior to ballot measure 5-10 years ago or so, or a little longer than that now, it doesn't seem that long ago, the commercial property paid in this state against tax rolls in comparison to what's paid today in real money, not inflated money, that their commercial property pays 1% less than they did 10 years ago. Residential property taxes paid have gone up on an average 48%. So there's that huge discrepancy. And in counties like Deschutes, where there's been substantial growth in homes, especially residential and some commercial, this type of significant change really affects your formula. I think also this particular formula tells a local district, don't support your local community college, because if you do, we're going to penalize you. If you manage to raise an operating levy or a capital or any other kind of levy that goes into your general funds for this, for running your school, we're going to penalize you because we're going to take money from the state away from you. And that's what I think this does. It's a real disincentive for people locally to support the community college, if I'm reading the formula correctly.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, on the last issue, if I could, we do exclude any local options that colleges go out for a vote, and we also exclude the capital construction bonds that come through the local vote from the funding formula in recognition that they are working hard to get those monies for their district. So another, I think, important thing is your comment about the funding formula being not simple. You are correct. The mechanics of the formula are very simple. The policy, the politics, and the implications are not simple. And that's why we are reviewing the formula for the future.
Follow-up?
Yes, Madam Chair. I want to go back over the last point. The present property taxes that go into the operating funds for the community college, if those were changed in the district, are you telling me that would not be part of the formula in the future?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, they would not be included in the formula if they were for capital construction bonds or for gap bonds, where colleges go out and actually have to ask voters to vote for those issues. We, by rule, exclude those from inclusion in the formula.
Follow-up. Mm-hmm. So the only property taxes that are included in the formula, the ones that exist at this point, and as they grow with changes as far as value of property, they continue to be counted. So those areas that have substantial growth are going to be affected by a reduction in state support, and those do not, would benefit. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that is generally correct, but also the number of students served will have some impact on that as well.
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, the only statement I'd make is that the formula, frankly, I don't think works anymore. I think we all agree to that. The question is how fast we fix it. I think there's going to be a budget note proposed that would propose that we fix it rather quickly, not over the next 2 years. And if that budget note's accepted, which I hope it will be, we might do some movement on this fairly quickly. But whether that occurs or not is up to other members of this body.
Thank you, Representative Bates. I also think it was Chair Morgan's intent today, too, that we have a discussion on the task force that's to be sent up to discuss this issue. And, Cam, I believe you were going to brief us on how that is going to be set up, the issues to discuss, and so forth. So if you or other members would like to comment on that, we would appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And in response to Representative Bates, your last comment, the Finance and Funding Task Force has been meeting for about the past 3 or 4 months. I'm afraid I don't have the date fixed in my brain. We're now meeting twice a month. It is our intention to have a conversation and a discussion with the full presidents, although they've been getting periodic updates, to really talk about the policy that undergirds the formula. That's really what we have been discussing with the 6 presidents that are participating in this task force. We have held ourselves to not sitting down at an Excel spreadsheet and plugging in numbers and seeing who wins and who loses while we have a discussion about what we believe to be true about what Oregon's intentions are around funding for its community colleges. So we wanted to do the basic policy foundation And once we have concurrence on those, then it seems time to talk about what revenues from property tax, state aid, tuition are included in any further computation of a formula. It is, and I think West Channel, President West Channel, who is the chair of the group, is here today, and he can certainly add additional comment, but it's our intention to have a product for review, a draft product, by August or September, and fully our intention to have this conversation with the State Board of Education, who has the authority to adopt a distribution formula for community colleges by January, February, March time frame. So we aren't, it was our collective decision, that of the State Board and the President's Council, to not wait and have this conversation, but to get right after it. And so that part of the reasoning there is that we want the colleges to have a firm idea about what their future looks like so that they can do the budget planning that's necessary for the 05 biennium and not do it by the at the 12th or 11th hour, but instead have sufficient time both to debate the formula that's put forward and then opportunity to figure out how it's actually going to work for each college.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
I'm wondering if some of those people participating in the task force want to come up and make some comments.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask a question or make a comment before this panel leaves.
Please. Send your resume. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I was pleased to hear Cam say that the fees are not or will be included in the task force discussions, because we also know that the fees and the registrations are not included right now. Also, if I could just make a couple of comments to add to what Representative Bates said earlier. Where there's some area that I don't understand fully yet is what the impact of local options are, particularly as our economy comes back and we see growth in the value of properties around the state. And on a long-term basis, it seems to me that what we have going on here, what we have set up, is quite frankly an incentive for more and more of our, on a percentage basis, of our costs of our community colleges to be borne by the state. I think, and I would agree that that's going to happen to some degree anyway, but what we're, along with what Representative Bates' comments, I think that is the long-term effect of the present formula. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wes Channel. I serve as president of Klamath Community College, and I hold the dubious honor of chairing a committee formed by the presidents to review the funding formula again and again. Without going beyond my brief from the presidents, I think it safe to say that we agreed some 6 months ago, I believe, that the funding formula needed to be seriously rethought. And we agreed it needed to be rethought from a policy perspective rather than a spreadsheet perspective. Toward that end, we assembled a group of presidents. Commissioner Brawley gave you names yesterday. Bob Barber from Central is here at the microphone next to me right now. The group of presidents includes presidents from large institutions, small institutions, institutions with high property tax, institutions with low property tax. It's across the board. It is very representative. Our direct intent is to try to make sense out of the way we distribute state funds to our community colleges, your community colleges, and at the same time maintain the fundamental intent of what community colleges are. That is a struggle on occasion. as we look at questions of local governance, as we look at questions of state vested interest versus local vested interest. And it is a balancing act. There are no clean answers. You are exactly correct. This is a very complex issue at very best. Having worked in four different states, having been in a state where in 14 years we had 12 legislatively written funded and form rentals, I can assure you that all of the presidents, and most of us have been in other states before being in Oregon, are recognizing that we are not dealing with a simple task. We are committed to having a work product that we can agree to, that we can take to our colleagues and have a very serious discussion about, and then make a firm recommendation supported by all of the districts. And I would presume, you know, we're talking about college presidents here, and ultimately I believe we need to be very, very careful. As a president, I work for an elected board. They're elected just like you are. So at some juncture, I would presume no college president would say amen to a funding formula unless their board says amen. Hopefully, by the time it gets to the state board, we will have at least a consensus of the districts about what's important and how it might work for all of Oregon for an extended period, so we're not back here 4 years from now having this discussion again. Now, that's our goal. And thus far, I would say I am very pleased with the progress. We are, in fact, having serious discussions at the policy level. We have not, as yet, resorted to spreadsheets. However, that's going to end relatively quickly, as we now must try to translate the words into equations. And timelines, August, for us to begin a full presidential discussion amongst all of us. October, hopefully, to be able to reach some consensus around that to go to the state board, and then it's in their hands as the agency charged by a statute with distribution of funds. And if you've got any questions about what we're doing, I'd be to try to go through all the issues we've discussed at this time is probably beyond the scope of my memory and your time.
Please, Scott.
Chairman Morgan, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share this time. One of the things I'd like to be careful of is the focus of much of the discussion is the use of the property taxes as part of the revenue base to fund the formula. And we keep shifting back to the discussion of the structure of the formula to distribute the property taxes. And the focus of the committee, or a large majority of the time, is spent on how do we distribute the revenues that are put into the formula. And that can distract us from one of the core issues, and that is what are the monies that are going into the formula. So I don't want to get distracted about the structure of the formula and how we distribute it. I'd like to continue some focus on what we put into the formula. The issue of the local property taxes as a revenue has not yet been resolved by the committee. And I think one of the key issues that we need to remember is that for some of us who have higher taxes per FTE, when our local communities passed their taxes, they didn't pass them for the sole purpose of funding credit courses. They funded them for the purpose of public service, outreach, access, and many of these local goals are not honored by the funding formula because the funding formula strives to achieve a low cost per FTE. So in some ways, we are using what the locals tax themselves for now to fund the state goals. You could almost imply it's a shell game. They may have taxed themselves to have a college center in Crook County. They may have taxed themselves to have cultural activities. They may have taxed themselves to do public service. Most of those will not be sufficiently funded by the formula. So what we're saying is even though you taxed yourself for that purpose, we're going to shift that money now into the state formula to achieve the state goals. And I think that's one of the key issues as to whether or not we are truly being accountable to the locals. At my board meeting last night, Crook County, which is most of you know is struggling economically and has some of the lowest tax rates and lowest graduation rates, we are closing their center because it's not profitable under the current formula.
We cannot run FTE. And they're saying, but we are paying our taxes for that center. And we're saying, well, the reality is we don't control enough of the taxes anymore to meet your initial goals, because now we are really working the formula game. So we're still into that issue of whether or not the use of the local property taxes is the appropriate revenue to meet all the state goals. I mean, that's the fundamental question. And how do we work with our locals? The question was asked in my budget committee last night by the representatives from Crook County is, can we lower our tax rate? Can we go back in and lower our tax rate? If you're only going to use the taxes to fund credit courses on the main campus in order to compete in the formula, can we lower our tax rate and be at the same tax rate as Portland or any other community that has a lower tax rate? And I had to say, legally, I think you can. And they're saying, well, we're not getting what we originally taxed ourselves for, so why are we going to continue taxing ourselves at this higher level? Why don't we just drop down where everybody else is and just meet the state goals? And we want to try and avoid that dialogue, but it's very difficult to do that with counties like Crook and Jefferson and Lake, which are not interested in taxing themselves anymore to not achieve what they were seeking. So I will stop there and say, yes, I think the committee is doing some excellent work, but I think the revenue issue is not being addressed head-on as it should be in terms of what goes into the formula. I'd also like to comment on the local option that Senator Messley picked up on. The local option currently does not go in the formula. If we were to pass a local option, there's no way I can pass a local option in my community. The level of trust is gone. I think if we truly want to make local option an option, we need to statutorily say local options. Because have it an administrative rule, it doesn't really play a sense of security. The administrative rule on the formula, and I'd have to lean to Cam or Brett, has probably been changed, if not every year, every other year, or every session. And you could change the administrative rule on the local option if you wanted to and sweep it right into the formula. I cannot guarantee to my locals that if they pass the local option, that at some point it would not be swept into the formula. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob raises a very important issue as you consider where you're going with overall community college funding. I sat here this week and listened as your staff advised you that property tax receipts were up, therefore state contributions should go down. Okay. We are at a question that Bob very appropriately raises. What revenues go in the funding formula? Whatever funding formula we write, regardless of what state we're in, regardless of what set of assumptions you plug into it, and whatever structure you put on it, revolves ultimately around how do we fund, how much do we fund for our institutions. And quite frankly, if the money's not there, no matter what we do with the funding formula, we will have consistently a declining service level to our students, and that's what we're about. As we go into it, I believe, as the preliminary presentations were made, the request was predicated on a cost per student times the number of students. That seems like a really straightforward thing. And my question would be, if we know how much it costs per student and we know how many students, why don't we have the conversation about the costs and the needs rather than predicating needs on funding levels? And I'm sorry, I'm a better businessman than I'm a college president frequently. Where I come from, we live and die based on cost per unit. We live and die based on how do we operate the business side of the business. And so perhaps I've gone beyond my brief, Madam Chair, and if I have, I apologize. This is certainly beyond the Funding Formula Committee's progress report, but it gets to a very fundamental issue, that being no funding formula can work inadequately funded. And I would hope that you would consider the implications at the policy level of your decisions as you go forward. And I recognize, we all recognize, it's a very difficult business to try to figure how to put everything in a box that's only half as large as it needs to be. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I very much appreciate how candid your comments have been. I think that a candid conversation is really the only way to get the issues clearly face up on the table. And so I want to thank you for that candidness. But I want to be equally candid back again to you. And I want to make it very clear that we realize the implications of the funding decisions that we're being asked to make this time. And it isn't just in the education arena that these very same issues are being discussed with the very same kind of heartfelt and very justified discussions that are taking place around them. But the reality of the situation is, and I think that you brought it out very clearly, that one of the problems that we have across all of the education levels is the level of trust that the public has in what's going on inside of the systems. I had a real wake-up call in my own county when I was down there a couple of weekends ago and did a town hall meeting. And education ended up being one of the big topics, and it happened to be the K-12 system. There had my local paper, my daily paper, runs what they call a question of the week, and the question of the week was, what do you think of the education system in Douglas County? And in order for people to get an answer into the question, they first of all had to read it in the paper, and then they had to have access to the net, and they had to go on the net to the newspaper's website and answer the question. So there was, over the course of the next week, a few hundred people that did that and answered the question. Well, the answer came back that over 80% of the people that responded thought that the education system in Douglas County was doing either a fair job or a poor job, and most of those thought that the education system was doing a poor job. And so that red flags immediately, because there is obviously some dramatic failure to communicate here what's going on inside of the community colleges and the K-12 system with the people that are being asked to pay the bill here. And part of the discussion that we are going to very seriously have in this building is how we're going to bridge the gap between the money that we can expect to receive. And please be very clear that that money is still declining. We haven't come to the bottom of our revenue fall off. How are we going to fill that gap between how much money we're going to have and how much service we want to provide? And a big piece of that is going to be talking to people out there that are going to be paying the bill on it. And so I can't underline strongly enough how critical it is for a dialogue, a meaningful, realistic dialogue, to be initiated and carried out here between the people that pay the bills in the state and the people that provide the services, because that obviously isn't happening. And I think that if we are going to ask people to put more money into the process, bearing in mind that there probably isn't very many people in this state that haven't had to cut their own personal lifestyle choices back and their own personal budgets back because of the economic situation that we're facing, that if those people, if in my county over 80% of them don't see the value in the education system, then I would submit to you that we have a huge problem on our hands. Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, point, counterpoint. Bob, you just said something that was counter to what I just heard over here from the department as far as the formula affecting your ability to raise local revenues to support your school district, or, I'm sorry, your community college district. What I heard was any money raised above what we have now under present rule is not going to the formula, but you told me that that is administrative rule can be easily changed, and it's a concern to you in trying to raise any local levy. Is there any disagreement in those two statements?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I don't think so. And let me just repeat, the basic tax base, which turned into a rate base, we cannot raise, and maybe Cam can explain that better. The only option that I have now would be a local option, which is the difference between 5 and 50. Or
it's the gap.
Right? It's the gap, right. And that currently, under administrative rule, is kept out of the formula.
So from, follow-up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. So from your point of view, the present formula is a disincentive for you to be able to pass any local levy for operations, not capital, but capital construction, but for local operational levies. Is that the way you see it?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, yes. It's a disincentive both for local option, which is the operating dollars, because our community would perceive and have said that they perceive that why would they add taxes. It's also a disincentive, to be honest with you, to do bonding packages for capital construction. I would like to say that we have a perfect communication system with our local community, and our local taxpayers fully understand that the capital construction bonds have nothing to do with the formula. In reality, they just see it as taxes, and they get very confused. And I believe the general electorate does not quite understand that the bonding packages are at risk. And so our board has chosen recently not to go out for a bonding package until the formula issues have been resolved, because it's such a complex issue to try and explain in the media in terms of our taxing. So we believe the formula is a disincentive in our community, I can't speak for others, to seek additional support from the taxpayers.
Madam Chair, I think what the reality may not be what the public hears, is the perception they have, and that's what's probably hurting them here, that we raise our property taxes and the money gets sucked away somewhere else, and so we're not going to do anything for the community colleges. And that's kind of sort of perception you get in the community sometimes. It makes it difficult for you to do things locally. It may not be real, but the perception becomes real. I'd also tell you that I'm going to follow up on the chair's points if I could. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens in one county is different than what happens in other counties, and it's all over the map in this state right now. In Jackson County, we just passed a levy to help our schools. The vote was 78% in favor of it. In Multnomah and Beaverton, you know what happened there also. But other parts of the state said no. And so it's all over the map. The question is, the really question here is, how much do you fund our educational system, and are we willing to raise the revenue to do so if we want to make changes? And that's going to be a huge question for all of us. And not to disagree with the good chair, but what happened in Douglas County, which is very significant, may not be true with the entire state. I don't think it is true with the entire state. Portland, which is the biggest part of the state, just voted essentially to increase our taxes for schools. We did in Ashland. I know we're not also the average for the state either. So somewhere in between those extremes is where we'll probably end up in this situation.
Thank you, Representative Bates. I appreciate those comments.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just one comment, and then I don't know if we've heard from my president, Carrion, while I've been out of the room.
No.
But I would love to hear his comments and some wisdom on the record. And I would ask all of our presidents in the community colleges community to give some thought to some replacement revenue for the current property tax piece of the structure for funding community colleges. You've heard me say before on this panel that there is an opportunity to look at a sales tax proposal that would fund pre-kindergarten, K-12, and community college programs. That's contained in the measure House Bill 3608. Again, as we have shifted our conversations in this building to a more serious consideration of revenue proposals, I would ask you to take a look at that piece with me, with us, and help us weigh how realistic is it to move our funding
a part of the funding for community colleges in that direction. Again, in the inaction of a sales tax is something that we could do here as legislators if we chose to do that this session. We have the constitutional wherewithal to do that. With that said, I am interested in hearing from President Jess before you get away to another state, Texas. Give us your insight. Give us some direction and guidance based on what you have learned about this community college system during the time that you've been here.
Thank you. Madam Chair, please. Senator Gordley, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. First and foremost, I can't add a lot to what for the record, Jesus Carrion, President of Portland Community College. I really can't add a whole lot to what the chair of our committee, Wes Channel, has said. He pretty well covered the basic issues, and it really comes down to a very simple fact. You can manipulate all the numbers you want, but you can only cut $10, and if it stays $10, you're not going to do anything else with it. That's the bottom line. It's a very, very extremely simple fact, and there's no way around it. Secondly, we've had to close centers ourselves in Columbia County and in Newburgh, and they're struggling with the same issue of the fact that they are taxed and what kinds of services do we provide to them. We had to look at a $20 million hole that we've had to fill for the next biennium. So while the perception that sometimes big has an economy of scale, one has to also realize that the economy also goes in the opposite direction in terms of the cost of operation. I think it's real important for our standpoint that while Portland Public Schools is struggling a little bit with its public perception, Portland Community College's perception from the public is extremely strong. We have a very solid reputation, and I know that for a fact by talking to our various legislators, to talking to the chambers, to the Portland Business Alliance. It's extremely strong, and I've made it a very focused effort, as Senator Gordley knows, to be very aggressive with the various communities, the communities of color, the business community, civic community, and the chambers. So I think that's, for us, we've been on the offensive for 2 years. I come back to an original statement that I made about a month and a half, 2 months ago, regarding the funding versus the distribution of dollars. The distribution formula, as the assistant commissioner said, Brett West, the mechanics are relatively simple. It's the politics and the actual dollars that go into it and the discussion around it makes it extremely complicated and sensitive. But I think the ultimate responsibility and all we can do as presidents is look at how can we take the existing dollars and hope to distribute them as fairly and as equitably as possible. Since I don't have baggage, let me be blunt, I don't carry baggage with the rural versus the urban. So I worry as much about those children out in the small rural areas as I do about the children in Portland. They're all our kids, K through 12. They're all of our students. And that worries me. So when I hear that attitude about, I can't relate to it because I worry about all the kids. The concern that I have is that the state has not come up with a K-16 vision. Where does K-16 fit within the realm of its economic development plan for the state? Once that happens, a funding decision needs to be made. Here's the level that we need to fund K-12 because, one, the population is growing and is becoming more diverse. And, two, where are the community colleges, which have a very distinct role? And I think Senator Messerly and I think perhaps Bates alluded, maybe we haven't done as good a job of making sure people understand who we are and what we do because we're pretty hardcore. In terms of getting people into work, transferring people to the four-year schools, retraining the workforce, et cetera, and then our four-year public institutions, which are outstanding, but could be better and could be stronger. We need world-class institutions so that our students that transfer from the community colleges don't go out of state; they stay here, and they flood our universities. But even them are now being capped, because they don't have the funds. Once that funding decision is made as to how they're going to be funded, then a strategy needs to be developed. And the fact of the matter is, you know, a sales tax, well, that's one option. Lifting the cap on the property tax, that's another option. The fact of the matter is, when you have health care costs rising at 21% a year that I have zero control over, that's a cost of operation. I contracts that are locally decided by our board, I have no control over the fact that there's certain things that are done, but I still have to negotiate those contracts. Other costs of operations that occur over and over and over again. Even if the state gave me no more money, gave us no more money at PCC this year, I would still have to cut. I would still have to figure out something, either to raise tuition or to reduce the budget, because of the cost of operation keeps going up. And I think that's the reality of the world that I live in. I don't have an option. Plus, I have to keep a solid reserve in order to protect the integrity, the fiscal integrity of the district. We've been rated our fiscal health. We have a higher credit rating than the state of Oregon, Portland Community College. We're going up for bonds to cover ourselves like some other colleges have been for the PERS, to deal with the PERS issue. And we just discovered that our credit rating is extremely strong. That doesn't come by happenstance. That's been very deliberate. The fact of the matter is, Senator Gordley, Madam Chair, and others, we're doing our best as presidents on this committee to come up with a policy-based distribution model. We can only do so much. The bottom line is the legislature and the governor and the people of the state of Oregon have to come to grips with the increasing number of students in the system, the diversity of the students in the system, and where do they want this state to go down the road. That's the bottom line. We can argue all day long about property tax, and obviously my colleague and I, Bob, are on opposite ends of the pole with on that. But that's okay. I mean, I respect his opinion, and I'm sure he respects mine. But the fact of the matter, we can argue about that all day long. But if there's only so many dollars that are sitting in the system, you can only keep dividing it. I mean, you can figure out, using a calculus and a logarithm, you know, thousands of different ways of splitting it, but you still have the same fact. There's only $10 that's sitting there. So I think I would only say, as I'm leaving, that I'm concerned about all the students in the state from K through 16 in the public educational system. And it's probably the greatest economic development weapon that you have as a legislature. I know we talk about business and we talk about, but the fact of the matter is, your educational system, our educational system, is your greatest weapon for a strong, healthy, and vital economy now and into the future. And you can either pay us now or pay later by increasing cost of having to take care of people who can't take care of themselves.
Thank you. Well said. And I'm very sure that the other members of the committee would join me in wishing you great success and the best in your the new stage of your career that you're entering into.
At the same time, Madam Chair, recognizing that it's a huge loss to the state of Oregon. And I hear in your message, a part of that message is you're telling us that Oregon does not have a clear vision for its K through 16 system. That's a piece of what we need to work on. I would amend that to say pre-K through 16 system.
Accepted.
Thank you. Committee members, we're very quickly coming to the time when we have to vacate the room. Are there any concluding comments or questions that members like to ask? What I'll do then is to close the information session on House Bill 5009. And we do not have the committee tomorrow because we have full.
That's correct, Madam Chair. Next week you will be working on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget. We will be getting some materials out to you at least the day before, the latest, for you to look over prior to the first day of the meeting. And I will be sending you information as to when that meeting will actually be, whether it'll be on Tuesday or not.
And with that, the committee is adjourned, and we will reconvene at the chair.